Like when he told us to like say something that we would have found in class, I was like, I couldn't even like look at that. Like that was like in the second paragraph.
They have their own folder here. They'll be very safe.
Like, you find a happy little
interview. And I expect to give them back next Tuesday.
Is it ours?
Yes. Can you do it today?
Sure.
Thank you. And then I hope you'll stay here today. We have some business to take care of, which is part of the class, too. So are you recording? Okay. Now, I promised to give out the take-home essay final assignment today. So I have it here. And I just want to know what usually happens. If I give you this, do you all then disappear and I see you again?
Yeah.
Or I'd say goodbye to you. or we return to class on Thursday and Tuesday.
We're here all the time.
You're the cardinals. There are another 50 people who never come. Never talk at all. And I appreciate having the core group here. If I can get one copy of it, I'll go through it with it. Go through.
Did we get extra credit for coming? Like when you can sit on the range, like
you're
keep in mind the core group is here on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think that it'll show up. It's already shown up. Some of the stuff you've written, it'll show up some more. So let's go through it again. It's due in my mailbox at 4 p.m. on December 18th. And then my mailbox is in University Towers. Okay, is everyone okay with that? We'll go through one piece at a time. I would not do that, particularly at that time of year, because the mail services. The University Towers is the biggest building on South University Avenue.
I guess I'll have to know where South University is, right?
South University starts at the Michigan Union and goes heads east from there.
Ulrich's Cafe
Joe.
Okay. There are two.
Two early neighbors going down.
Right next door to Clinton.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like
two tall buildings in there.
No,
one is over here on
South
Main,
Forest.
And the other
Forest.
Forest.
Yeah, South Forest.
That's
Cross Street. South Forest and then South University.
And the history department's on the second floor. And you can get into the building until 5 o'clock. I'd like to have them by 4, that's why I said 4 o'clock. So none of you have problems with it.
If they're done early, can they just go there?
Yeah, put them in there. That's fine. And I don't mind if you have discussions with others in the class regarding the work at hand, but your writing must absolutely be your own individual work. Quotations should be footnoted. And arguments from sources we've read should be cited by source and page. Or if you're restating something or using some points that are made in the lecture, you could say lecture, Cohen's lecture, Cohen's lecture. If you know the date, that would be fine. Yeah. And I'd like to see some detail in the specific detail in the essays to anchor and support your discussion. Because this is a take-home exam, I'll expect that your writing is sound, will be sound. So do review your work carefully, correct your work, and revise and check it again before producing your final essays. So there are then two sets here, two pairs, and so you choose one from Roman numeral one and one from Roman numeral two. And I'm real concerned, I did a lot of thinking about this, spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I do not want you to say, well, I like A and B at number one, so I'm just going to do that. And I'm just going to, you know, it doesn't seem like I'm a hard and fast kind of person, but on this one, I really want you to choose one. I absolutely require you to choose one from Roman numeral one and one from Roman numeral two, and not do two from the same one. Indeed, I think you'll see how in Roman numeral one, the two different the choices have a kind of conversation with each other. So it wouldn't make sense to, as an exam, to have you write on both ends. So Jelliba and Mabo did, after all, meet again in this, but just those of you who are so fed up with that, don't want to see any more of that, you can just skip past that and do it something else. So A is, we have read histories of two African kingdoms or empires, the Mali Empire and the Zulu Empire. Both histories are at least in part based on oral tradition, and both deal with the foundation of new and powerful states in Africa. I want you to compare these two treatments in terms of the question of ethics of domination. And then B is, Jelliba comes to meet Mabo a third time. This time, Mabo is a graduate student in history. You could say at the University of Dakar, which has a distinguished graduate program, African history. He reads aloud to Jelliba the entirety of the Mafola book, because we assume that Jelliba is not a reader himself, so versed in oral tradition that he would want to read, hear this book, or come to grips with it as an oral reading. The two discuss whether the constitution of powerful centralized states in Africa is, after all, something that should be celebrated. But certainly with a Sundiata epic, as presented by Nian, it is a celebration of the foundation of a kingdom or empire. Whereas for us, and probably for Mabo, the Mofolo book raises questions about what is there to be celebrated about the establishment of a powerful kingdom or a powerful state. So I'd like you to construct a conversation between Jelliba and Mabo on this issue as they define some of the positive and negative features of the Mali and Zulu states, and as they consider some of the issues surrounding the relationships of some African states with the unfolding Atlantic slave trade, another arena in which we have come across questions about the way in which African states participate in the slave trade and how, to what extent this is a positive or negative feature. And also not forgetting, or while also recognizing, the perspectives of the authors of the two works. That is, they each are presenting a kind of perspective on the state. And you should take that into account. Then under Roman numeral two, in recent decades, much has been said about overpopulation on the African continent. Some have termed this population bomb, and some have attributed crises in African development to high rates of fertility and reproduction on the African continent. Even some I didn't really want to put it in here, have attributed to heightened, what they consider as heightened sexuality among people on the African continent, or African people. In some of these arguments, there is a sense that the essential features of Africa were relatively stable, even resistant to change from time immemorial. And in other arguments, there is the view that the essential features of Africa changed dramatically under the influence of events and forces outside Africa's control. In a well-argued essay, develop a portrait of the population issue in Africa, Africa's early past up to the 19th century, confronting this question of continuity and change. And the last is taking a quote from Thornton, and developed an essay on it. He says, my examination of the military and political relations between Africans and Europeans concludes that Africans controlled the nature of their interactions with Europe. Europeans did not possess the military power to force Africans to participate in any type of trade in which their leaders did not wish to engage. Therefore, for all African trade with the Atlantic, including the slave trade, had to be voluntary. I think there's a lot of grist to take up in that one. Are there any questions? Well, you know, we can take some few minutes and discuss each and any one of these. Yeah,
can you further define the ethics of domination? Or question A, part one?
Well, I think that the point applies in both, is that that there's no doubt that we're talking in both of these examples and in other ones dealing with Africa about systems of domination in which there are rulers and ruled. And you'll remember that I put on the board this a couple times, this continuum of nice and evil. You know, that there seemed to be forms of domination in Africa that were organized and cultivated to attract people voluntarily to join a leader and provide that leader with more persons, more power, more reproductive capacity. And that, you know, that's what I put on the night, those kinds of practices that were associated with that form of leadership or domination, we put on, you know, I drew some out of the discussion we had and put them on over on the night side of the continuum. And then there were other forms of domination that revolved around seeming involuntary means of control that could identify through conquest of other peoples, through subjection of people to forced labor and slavery, and through other elements of control, you know, life and death control over individuals, a low regard for the lives of subjects on the part of rulers, and that is we put on sort of the evil side of the continuum. Now, that was just the nice and evil continuum was just put there to have, you know, a system of discussion. I'm not asking you to buy into that. It just seems a way that we could differentiate, one way we could differentiate different practices of leadership, different practices of domination. Then there's another aspect of the ethics of domination I think you should think about that came out of some of the discussions and I think is in some of the readings, is that domination isn't only about the exercise of power over people and the way in which leaders and rulers choose to exercise their power, but it's also about the way subjects understand and participate in these forms of domination. I see ethics being sort of like there is a, you know, maybe two axes. One, something like the nice and evil, but there's also an axis that has to do with the perspective of whose benefit is all this production of power and expression of power. Mm-hmm. Whose end? Whose benefit? And I think different people in a social or political situation will have different understandings of what those ethics are.
That really applies to Zulu, because I did my paper on Terrific Majesty, and I thought it was really ironic that the Europeans, the British who were in Natal, were condemning Shaka's, because when Shepstone started his system of native administration, they condemned Shaka's way of ruling his people. In the end, all they wanted to do was force the African people into labor themselves.
Mm-hmm. And were willing to adapt a Shaka-like system into their own administration.
To do that.
So-called natives, you know.
Right, and I just think that's really ironic. Just it depends on the perspective. Like, both systems could be considered evil because it's, you know, it's forced labor. And
there's something that that's in my mind that you saw it in this book, in the book, but it is this Zulu praise expression that's sometimes spelled Bayete, and sometimes Bayete. And it's in Mafolo's book, and it's also in Carolyn Hamilton's book, is that this is the praise. Remember, in Mafolo's books, one of the things he did introduce, Shaka introduced, when he organized his power, was this praise, Bayede, which when people met him or saw him, they would use this expression, which is, you know, all the films of the Nazi Germany as Heil Hitler, it's a similar kind of praise, except that this should only be used for the king or the ruler of the Zulu. And paradoxically or curiously, it was also used for Shepstone, you know, uniquely, but not used for anyone else. So, I mean, it's very powerful in the 1980s when 250,000 people, or in 1907 or 1908, 250,000 people call out Bayede simultaneously. Now, for the South African government and white observers of this, this praise, when hundreds of thousands of people spoke this praise simultaneously, chanted it, you had a kind of Nuremberg-type effect. It was extremely powerful and influential, and it promoted this idea that all Zulu believe simultaneously, believe equally in the power of Shaka or the power of Shepstone. But, I have cause to wonder whether people who chant a praise in a mob or a crowd all have the exactly same feeling about what the praise is and what the leadership is. It's something that you do in a crowd. And I think it actually may suggest just the opposite, that there are all kinds of tensions about what this authority over individuals meant and how individuals would participate in this system. So that if an individual, all he had to do was to show his loyalty to Shaka was at the right moments to produce this praise, it doesn't say much more than that about the loyalty of people. It might may say less about their loyalty. All you have to do is sing this praise. mm-hmm. chant is praised. And so, you know, I think it just opens up questions about the sign of seams and crevices and differences among people and how they respond to leadership and how the perspective is different, and that they're, and this is what I mean by an ethic or ethics of domination in that sense. So that's what I'm getting at. Thank you for your and other questions about the other one? Again?
Yeah. For part 2B, can it be
opinionated? In Asante society, there is someone who speaks for the chief. You don't, the chief doesn't speak there. You speak to this person. It's called the. The Ochame. And your time is no Ochame. Go ahead.
For part B, can it be opinionated?
Would you speak a little louder?
Can part B be opinionated for 2B?
You mean, can you express your opinions? Or?
Yes.
Well, I think that you, from our readings and the work you've done already, you know that Jelaba is a griot, an oral, yes. A specialist in oral tradition who has a
2B.
2B.
No,
yeah. The one about Thornton.
Oh, Thornton. Your opinions. Yeah, but I think they should be informed. Don't you think? I mean, I'll go out the door and walk in and say, this is a load of nonsense. Okay. how many is that? 6 words or something? But I'd like more than that, you know, because maybe the next person comes in and Thornton says, you know, I've got all the detail. I got all the, I have all those maps. I know everything going on in the subject, and you've got to produce some stronger argument than then this is just a bunch of nonsense. I've actually heard Thornton respond to critics in that way. He produces a lot of information for you, and so does Reader, I think, to develop an argument with him. But it also, you know, I think it not only calls for some detail, some empirical detail, it also, you can also address the logic or illogic of this argument. You know, why in the heck use the word voluntary in the system or something? You know, that's just a starting point. You know, why? What is it about this whole discussion that a word like voluntary becomes such an important word to form an argument?
I'm just going to say that this question seems more like it's answers your sixth theme of the course, which is Africa determined or negotiated. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if you could take the stance, well, this is wrong because Reader said this, or you could say this is right because Thornton said this, and he uses this information.
Well, I think it helps you find, I think you're exactly right, it helps you find a way in discussing the complexities of that determined or negotiated, you know, that it's kind of like this space you get into and you can't quite liberate yourself from the space because the issues are, you know, about whether Africans have agency, do things on their own, you know, if you say they're involuntary, then what is it going to say about Africans' ability to form and constitute their own societies, form states, and participate in economies and so on.
Not to be cute or anything, but I answered that exact question for my paper. And I'm not sure, but I think I did a pretty good job on it. And I simply reproduced it. I even used this quote.
I think I did.
Try to tear it apart, but.
Uh-huh. Did I find the weak link in the Thornton's letter? Did we all find
it? No, actually, I used another quote with similar.
And so the question is, can
I'm just wondering, I mean, I don't want, I mean, will you consider it plagiarism if I cheat off myself, or? Will you remember it, if I write
something? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. they're two different exercises, and they're independent of each other, and you have to make your own judgment. And I'm not gonna put them one down compared to the other one in detail. You know, I'll just have an idea. You know, I write little notes to myself. I have this residential college practice of, you know, that you're supposed to write comments, not just grades. So I have comments on each paper. So I will know what your paper's done. But I'm not. If you want to do that, that's fine. Okay.
Well, I was sort of thinking the same thing when I saw it. I guess the way that I read it is that the assignment about the book review was to review the book in comparison to itself, whereas the question here is comparing it to other books, other things from the class. Mm-hmm. So it would be a completely different answer.
I think so, probably. Yeah, unless the first was stretched in some way. Okay. So, I wanted to start talking today and Thursday about the 19th century. Are you okay about moving ahead? Okay. One general point that I comes to mind is that African historians of the 20th and 21st centuries seem to need a 19th century Africa for certain things. And I'd like to just put that on the table, what this need for being able to characterize 19th century Africa in certain ways. Is that from the 1880s, virtually all of Africa came on within 20 or 25 years between 1880 and 1905, virtually all of Africa came under European imperial domination. And Europeans sought to create institutions to control Africans, to get their labor, to have Africans pay taxes, to pay the cost of administration, other things I talked about early in the course. And this new system that the British, French, eventually the Italians, also the Belgians, and the Germans, up until the end of the First World War, that they were trying to evolve there was, as I've said at different times, a couple times, supposed to be a cheap system that paid for itself. Europe was not willing to invest huge amounts of resources in the administration of these colonies. And some of the arguments about how Europeans got into these colonies is that they backed in them against their own interests and wishes, political kind of diplomatic struggles having to do with Europe were transferred onto the African continent, and claims were made in Africa for different territories, the French doing this to react against the Germans, or the British doing this to react against the French, that in Africa people were exercising countries in Europe were exercising their interests even when they saw the dangers of getting involved, the dangers and costs of getting involved more deeply in Africa. And the 19th century, that is the period, let's say, from the late 18th, call it a kind of average 19th century, from the late 18th, from 1780s or 1790s up until the 1880s, this era was one in which European interest companies, governments were all over the place in Africa, but were withholding themselves from getting more deeply involved. The reason that I think historians need a certain kind of 19th century Africa, or why Europe needed a certain kind of 19th century Africa, is that they have to do their arguments about empire, about their arguments about empire, about their responsibilities, were, she's not working on it, said she had to leave early, had to be configured around two kind of competing principles. One principle was that that Africa needed the involvement of Europeans, the justification for Europeans being there, that Africa needed civilization, it needed modernity, it needed European presence to completely end the effects of the slave trade and slavery in Africa. So that there was an absolute need for Europe to come in and transform Africa, this kind of transformative need, reform or transform. And second, that, well, Europe was smart, benign, humane, and wasn't going to transform Africa very much. It was going to work with Africans in their own institutions, bring people along slowly, steadily, through education, through giving people marginal rights, through protecting their rights, through protecting African institutions. And these two arguments that came about in the early 20th century, or the late 19th and early 20th century, that Africa had to be transformed and Africa had to be retained, were two arguments that went hand in hand and kind of worked with each other and against each other. And Europe, neither Europe or Africa could escape from the effects of these two. So that given the presence of those two positions, those two arguments, 19th century Africa, it would be useful if 19th century Africa could be presented as a period of terrible strife, difficulties, kinds of a lot of negative things going on in Africa that needed to be ended, cured, and healed, or simultaneously, that all those things that people thought about Africa, that it was primitive and uncivilized, were actually kind of wrong, that there were institutions in Africa that Europeans could work with, that there were states that could be grafted on in a kind of Shepstonian manner onto European institutions and made to work to keep the price of imperialism costs down. So that when people, historians and others, attempted to develop pictures of the 19th century, this long 19th century, the pictures that they developed seem to have these two features of them. A look towards, a look at events in the 19th century as representing Africa's own reform of itself, of its own problems, of dealing with its own problems in ways that could be made, thought of as continuous with the new reforms that Europeans were bringing in. Or, secondly, that Africa could be representative, events in Africa could be representative of something as an anathema to African, to European ideas about what settled civilization should be. And the Zulu, the story of the Zulu Empire, you can see, is a story about, you know, how, is also a story about how Europeans or South African government, society at large was dealing with that phenomenon. The Buganda society I mentioned, talked about last week, is an example of a set of processes and developments underway that Europeans heralded as representing, could herald as representing the capacities of African institutions to reform and build themselves in ways that would cheapen the costs of imperial responsibility. and could be incorporated in the imperial world, imperial system. And so then what was going on, you talked about South Africa, East Africa, what is going on in West Africa? Well, the major characteristics of West Africa, there are, in a sense, for the 19th century, there are, to oversimplify a little bit, there are two West Africas. There is the area of the former empires of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, the Sahelian or Western Sudanic region, north of the West African forest, represented today by countries of Senegal, Gambia, Mali, Burkina Faso, parts of Guinea, northern Cote d'Ivoire, northern Ghana, parts of southern Niger, northern Nigeria, southern Chad, northern Cameroon. But this belt of this Sahelian or Sudanic belt was one region. The other region was this area that had now for several centuries been contact directly with European trading institutions and the Atlantic trade, especially the Atlantic slave trade. And so there were really two arenas in which significant events took place in the 19th century. For the period, for this Sudanic period, that's what I want to talk about today, and I'll try to go through swiftly this. The major characteristic or major event that was repeated over and over again throughout the region was the Islamic Revolution, a transformation of a society, once one region, sub-region of the Sudanic belt, after another by a movement that we call an Islamic revolution. And I have a quote here that pretty much from Adu Bohan's paper in our readings, and parts of it comes from Ajay. You can find the citation, actual citation to Ajay. And Ajay is another one of our readings. But this is a different article, that takes these series of Islamic revolutions, pretty much reduces them to two or three sentences. And I think that it pretty much represents what the general story is of these revolutions. What was going on in the Sudan around 1800 was that the old system of empires in the Western Sudan had fallen away about two centuries earlier. And what one had were a series of small states or city-states, hundreds of them across the Sudan, each with their own governance, each with their own local economy, their own methods of extraction, but across the whole region, you would say, if you were looking at them, they would be over any kind of 100, 200, 300 mile region, they'd look pretty similar. If you compared the ones in northern Nigeria to the ones in southern Mali, they would look different, but the ones in northern Nigeria would look pretty much the same, and if you moved across the belt, there would be similarities in any small region. That's kind of probably an obvious point. They were interconnected by trade routes, market systems, calendrically organized market systems that moved around among the states, and connections also through networks of Islamic scholarship that connected almost all these city-states were governed by Muslim rulers and had within their the cities an urbanized elite population that was substantially Muslim. And in every one of these cities-states, almost every one of them, there was at least one mosque, central mosque, that was center of Islamic scholarship and learning. And Islam was not only seated in the town, but was a means of connection of the whole region in and of itself and to Islamic communities all over the world through periodic pilgrimages, through the travel, through trade among Muslim traders. But the slave trade had in its own time pulled resources away from these networks into exchange systems of the Atlantic. And I think most historians agree that this area of the Sudanic Belt became poorer as a result of the Atlantic slave trade. The whole region became impoverished. It was dependent on long-distance trade, production for long-distance trade, and those trade routes moved south, and the controlling elements of those slave trade, those routes moved south. This is one explanation for the collapse of these large empires, is there was apparently very little profit involved in holding them all together that could support a broad imperial system that could claim control of city-states over 500 or 1,000 miles. So that by 1800, these areas were probably between 1500 and 1800, this whole region had gone through a process of economic decline. And at the same time, the slave trade had probably introduced the slave trade across the Sahara. The slave trade to the south had probably strengthened the use of forced labor or slave labor in the economies of these city-states, so that on the one hand they became poor, on the other hand they became more involved with the organization of labor, organization of society based on force and forced labor. There were in the 19th century there were four major Islamic revolutions that took place in West Africa that were clearly related to one another. There were other revolutions east of there in the Sudan, in Chad and Sudan, that were not as closely related, though the timing of them could be said to be related. There was the Hausalan Revolt of 1804, and these revolutions in the western, in this area of Senegambia and Mali and Guinea, three of them, that lasted right up into the time that the French started to occupy the Senegambia region, and they began to go inland and become involved with the those communities that were in revolt in the 1870s. Summary Touré is considered an Islamic revolutionary, but also is one of the leading examples of resistance to European conquest beginning in the 1870s and into end of the 1880s. And each of these revolutions involved the unmaking of traditional political authorities in the region, the establishment of a caliphate with a leader and a state based on Islamic principles, and the building of or the spreading of Islam from the cities, from the elite, to the mass of the population, or beyond. I shouldn't say from the elite, to the mass of the population, because the mass of the population was generally in revolt against the elites. There are I'm going to go to Roman numeral 28. These revolutions look similar to one another. Yeah.
So you just said each revolution. They unmade the governments.
Unmade the traditional, overthrew the traditional authorities in the region where they operated. There are two general process models of Islamic revolutions in Africa or in the world. One is based on a sociological comparative analysis of a number of revolutions. That's the outline, that's 1 through 6. And the second is that there's actually a model within Islamic thought and Islamic historiography, a model of revolution that is based on a Prophet Muhammad's own life history. And they, you know, in some ways they interrelate, in some ways they don't. And I think it's pretty interesting to keep both of them in mind. And I've put them there. You can look at them yourself. I wanted to talk specifically about the revolution in Islamic revolution in northern Nigeria, what was called Hausaland, that began in 1804. In the late 18th century, there was a militant form of Islam spreading across the west, the Sudan region, moving from west east. One of the, if you just look at the 19th century and you look at when these revolutions take place, it looks like they spread from east to west, but that's because we haven't looked at the revolutions in the 18th century. Is that in the 18th century there was a series of Islamic revolutions in this region, and it's from there that the ideas and some of the personnel involved in revolutions to the east spread and then worked back west again. And in northern Nigeria, started to this region here, which today has probably 100 or 120 million people, it started experience the movement into the region of militant Islamic leaders associated with the Tijaniya Brotherhood. These were ascetic, devout, fundamental believers in Islam who moved about these regions and maintained contact with each other. And under the Tijaniya, there were a series of sort of subunit brotherhoods, and it was the Torah Bay, specifically the Torah Bay Brotherhood, within the Tijaniya that moved into this region of northern Nigeria. And what one of the things that happened is the Torah Bay were particularly associated with the Fulani or Fula or Pul, P-U, speaking people, who tended in this period to be more mobile, to be pastoralists or semi-nomadic, who moved back and forth across this region, sometimes carrying trade goods, sometimes just moving the livestock animals from one place to another, and reestablishing themselves over time further to the east. And the Torah Bay were especially associated with the Fulani, Fula-speaking people. I think I've spelled this right. I think it's P-E-U-L. Sometimes the language family is called Pular or Fula. And what they found when they got to northern, as they came into northern Nigeria, is they found the city-states dominated by rulers who were Hausa-speaking, and the states, the cities themselves, were Hausa-speaking. One of the Fula teachers was named Uthman Danfodio, and he got into a series of arguments, of kind of Martin Luther type arguments, with the Islamic clerics who were associated with the rulers of these Hausa city-states. And the argument went like this. The Uthman said that while these rulers were Muslim, claimed to be Muslim, and while they accommodated Muslim scholars and protected the mosque in their towns, that they did not abide by the restrictions, the ideals of Orthodox Islam. And that, in fact, that the rulers' patronage of the Muslim scholars in the towns, the patronage of Islam in the town actually was actually the opposite of what it looked like. That it was a way of maintaining the illusion of an Islamic community without it being Islamic at all. It allowed the rulers to get away with having the presence of this more cosmopolitan population in the town and being able to kind of domesticate them to the interests of the Hausa city-state. And the rulers' own identification with Islam was a pretense in order to keep these foreign elements who connected them through trade systems, cultural systems, to the wider world. And so that what Uthman was saying was that Islam was being maintained in these city-states pretty much as a foreign accommodation to a foreign religion. And what he was calling for was a complete transformation of the society into an Islamic Islamic society. And destruction of this compromised, corrupt system of Hausa governance. What he had going for him was this sort of economic crisis, this kind of steady state of depression in the area, and the effects of the ruler, Hausa rulers' tax systems specifically, or labor tax and labor systems, where in spite of depression, these Hausa city-state rulers could keep up their way of life, their control, through heavily taxing the income and labor of the people knowing the towns and the surrounding areas. And this was a map so that underneath or alongside this call to Orthodox Islam was this economic interest, this kind of social interest in and tax revolt. And what the other, so Uthman had going for him a response to an economic crisis, negative feelings about the rulership, taxes, labor, and he also was able to use the Fulani, his connection to Fulani, to bring to his side, into his movement, the Fulani who lived in these city-states. And the Hausa-speaking people who lived in the countryside. So it became kind of a combination movement. You had the Hausa in the countryside who didn't like the taxation of the city, their city masters. You had the Fulani who saw this Islamic movement as something like a Fulani movement that could overcome Hausa domination. He had the religious this religious debate where he claimed the high ground, the Orthodox ground. And within a few years, he had a, you know, in northwest part of this northern Nigerian region, he had the Hausa leaders worrying about a kind of steady state of revolt. And they started to act against the movement after they found that Uthman would not compromise. They tried to negotiate compromises, and he said, there's no compromise. You can't compromise these kind of Islamic principles. We need an orthodox Islamic society. That's what we're calling for. And there is no compromise. No accommodation is possible. And so in the course of that, he moved into this role of the classic story of the prophet Muhammad. He declared, went into exile, declared a jihad, which is a holy war, against these city-states. And one by one, they fell, or he conquered every single one of them in northern Nigeria. The fact that these city-states were already at odds with each other, in tension one from another, meant that he could pick them off, he and his movement could pick them off one at a time. And he established in each city-state an emirate. Each city-state was led by an emir under what was the caliphate of and there were 14 emirs, which correspond to pretty much the 14 districts of northern Nigeria that the British established in the early 20th century when they established a protectorate over northern Nigeria. And then Uthman said, I have done my work. It's taken 27 years. I've done this. I've established a caliphate, a holy Islamic state in this region. We have converted the people of this region. I mean, substantially, he was correct that from there being a very small percentage of people who were actually practicing Islam, it came to be a very large percentage of the population was after this 27-year period. He had, in a way, created a revolution, a massive change in law, social life, and so forth. But he then retired and left everything in the control of the 14 emirs and of his sons, who went on to allow the emirs to each develop their own administration. And each of them, in order to develop the resources of their own emirate or their own city-state, started to adopt the regional Hausa titles, to incorporate some of the old Hausa leadership into their governments, to recognize Hausa law as operative in their emirates, and to slowly, steadily yield the perfect ideal Islamic state in their own areas. And I think what the story, you know, is an old story of very hard to sustain a revolution, the ideals of a revolution. It's possible to win a victory, but sustaining it over a long period of time, creating a permanent structure, is really testing. And you know, one sees this in Iran. Iran, you know, in our lifetimes has had a very important Islamic revolution, and it is having difficulty now sustaining it. There's all kinds of other issues that this Islamic theory, Islamic law, in its orthodox form, cannot work out, are being exercised by people, or sought to exercise other interests in other ways. And the momentum of the revolution, the original Islamic revolution, just can't be sustained forever. Now, to bring you up to date, in northern Nigeria, there is a new ferment. I would say it's a perhaps 10 years old, and it is to institute more fully Islamic law into the life of northern Nigeria, into the legal, social, and political framework of northern Nigeria. And one state after another out of these 14 or so states now in northern Nigeria is introducing Islamic law as the guiding law of the state. And there are tremendous conflicts going on about the establishment of Islam in societies that are in the Nigerian nation. And the government, through three governments, has not known how to deal with this movement. And so that this, at the end of the 19th century, what we have is that substantial transformation of this arena of the Western Sudan into an Islamic society that is not just represented by elites in the cities, but throughout the population, where a greater part of the population, any area in the Western Sudan, identifies themselves as Islamic and practices Islam, and is open and susceptible to reform, new Islamic reforms, new Islamic fundamentalism, and to building building a nation within a nation, Islamic nation within a more diverse nation like Nigeria or Cote d'Ivoire. And right now in the Ivory Coast, this is a major issue there, where an Islamic leader who was disbarred from running for president, now it seems like some negotiation is taking place how to bring him back into the government. His name is Ouattara. On Thursday, I want to shift to the this coastal region and talk about these transformations taking place in that region.
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure, did you say it was wrong to look at it as these revolutions, the unmaking of traditional authorities and the establishment of Islamic, the spread of Islam, is it wrong to look at it as the elite spreading it to the masses, or is that the way?
No, it's wrong to look at it as the elites spreading it to the masses. That was a misspoke on my part. It's that these were tended to be mass movements with new kinds of leadership that hadn't been seen in these parts of West Africa before. Leaders who were came out of these brotherhoods and were antagonistic or wanted to overthrow the more privileged Islamic scholars and leaders, clerics and judges that operated in each of these towns, that they felt, each of these city states, that they felt saw as corrupting. So, they could, because it came from outside the city states, they could attack the system of the city-state model of, here you have a heterogeneous population under the head of a ruling family that is connected to a ruling family over here, a ruling family over there. We saw like in the Sundiata case, this probably goes back to that model that comes from the archaeologist McIntosh, of the McIntoshes that we heard about and read about in Reader and had the article, where there were these heterogeneous towns that each seemed to have their own governance system, their own local economies, but connected to network. And that system, which seems to have lasted at least 3,000 years, seemed to be overthrown by these mass movements, Islamic movements, in these revolutions. but there was also a tendency for the revolutions to run out of gas and to reaccommodate this traditional leadership and bring them back into the system. In a way, it's a revolution, but there's an old, long-established system that won't go away. And you can look at the political topography of this, and it maintains itself through ancient city-states, the conquests of Uthman Danforio, the British incorporation of northern Nigeria as a protectorate, through the various governments of Nigeria attempting to create a federal system through the establishment of these states. You know, the political topography of this remains pretty stable in spite of that we had imperialism working backwards, new governments, new ideas of federalism, imperialism, and an Islamic revolution.
Yeah. On the same note, you may have said this, but the leaders, like Uthambo, is it?
Uthman Danforio.
I think it was like, these were local people. They weren't foreigners coming to this region, right?
Well, Uthman Danforio was local to this region up here, but he wasn't local to, you know, where the conquest ended up.
But it wasn't, so I guess it wasn't trans-Saharan.
No.
Okay.
No, all of them could, you know, like in Buganda, all of them could claim to be local. You know, because if you were a Fulani, you would claim that you could be anywhere local. You had local connections wherever you were. Then you could always claim to be local, but you could also be sort of dispatched to some kind of foreign element. You know, these Fula, they just herd animals. You know, they don't know anything about governing cities. They're not from here. They're not from this town. They come from somewhere else. So, I mean, there are competing arguments, political arguments about who these people were, what their values were, what their worth was. Okay, said enough and probably